You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vale, and I'm speaking with Joseph Engel, founder and CEO of There Is No Hero in Heroin Foundation of Las Vegas. The nonprofit organization is hosting its annual Recon Recovery Conference next month, featuring former Miss USA Tara Conner. Joseph, thank you so much for being here today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I really appreciate you taking the time and allowing us to speak about our event.
Yeah, so first of all, what is the organization, There's No Hero in Heroin?
There's No Hero in Heroin Las Vegas chapter started in 2012 upon the heels of me losing my oldest son to a heroin overdose in 2011. The original foundation started in Tucson, Arizona. Subsequently, in 2015, we became the parent foundation. So we've been active in the Las Vegas Valley since 2013 at one level or another to try to help adolescents who experience substance use disorder.
Wow. Okay. And I mean, it's a really sad origin story of the Las Vegas chapter. And, you know, so many great organizations and groups are born out of unthinkable tragedy, but not everyone who experiences tragedy is able to turn that into something positive. What was it that inspired you to move forward and make a difference in the world?
Multiple things. You know, when something like that is as devastating as losing a child, my whole soul was cracked wide open. And I'm open at that point to want to help. And I am a person in long-term recovery. At the time of my son's passing, I was 17 years clean and sober in a 12-step abstinence-based program. And the years leading up to his death, I was running around town trying to manage his addiction, and I was connected to a program of recovery, and I still did not know how to help my own son. And it occurred to me that, you know, if I'm connected to a program of recovery, and what about the parents that are not connected? They really don't know what to do. So that was the driving force, was for me to try to help clear some of the red tape. And here it is 10, 11 years later, and I'm still almost at a loss. I mean, we've made inroads, we've had some successes, but it is still just a horrific disease, substance use disorder, and mental health.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, how does substance abuse in Nevada compare to other states?
A little bit higher. Certainly, we, you know, there are places that are worse and there are places that are better, but we are just a little bit higher than the middle. And the death results from overdoses have skyrocketed, due large in part to the introduction of fentanyl, which seems to have made its way in darn near every substance known to man.
Yeah. So what specific services do you offer clients who are dealing with substance addiction?
We offer peer recovery support services as our primary what we do. Persons with lived experience, when we started doing that, there was not even a state certification for that. We were early adapters with that trend. But persons with lived experience is what the way it's titled. They're like a paraprofessional, you know, like not a complete professional, you know, like a paramedic, paramilitary, paraprofessional is a peer. There's somebody who has lived experience and they know they have been there where most of our adolescents have been. And then they've come out the other side of it and the adolescents seem to listen to them better. And we, in addition to that, we offer intensive outpatient counseling, you know, clinical ASAM, American Science for Addiction Medicines. They set the standard. So we have clinicians on staff. And most recently, we have started a sober living houses for adults.
Wow, awesome. Okay. So what's the Recon Recovery Conference that you've got coming up next month all about?
The Recon Recovery Conference is a brainchild of two former board members for No Hero in Heroin. Our Black Monday event was basically a symposium for the past 10 years, a symposium and a recovery resource fair and treatment fair. And it has grown to be the largest resource fair in the state of Nevada for the past 5 years. And we had an idea to actually expand it to like a all-day conference. So we wanted to make it a recovery conference. And hopefully we'll be able to do it to a 2 or 3 day conference. But this year we're offering clinical CEUs, or, you know, for licensed mental health professionals. They have to get a certain amount of continuing education units in order to stay compliance with the state. So we're offering CEUs, we're offering professional development for teachers, we're offering CMEs, clinical, you know, for medical personnel. You know, everybody needs this continuing education. So that's going to be the first half of the day. And then the second half of the day is going to be our keynote speaker, our sobriety countdown, our remembrance video, and our resource fair.
So what's the significance behind the former name of your event, Black Monday?
There really is none. That was that I had mentioned that there was a founder, a lady named Jan Narji from Tucson, Arizona. And when she had enlisted me to start the Las Vegas chapter, this was an event that she had come up with. And she picked the name, and she always picked the Monday that was closest to Valentine's Day, because we, most of us have lost people. So their Valentine's Day were the people that we held closest in our hearts. So other than that, I mean, there's no significance that, other than she was the founder and she asked me to keep it the same name.
Got it. Okay. And now it's no longer on a Monday. This year it's going to be on a Saturday.
It's going to be on a Saturday. So it has been, we had 10 years running Black Monday, and it was a great run. But I got to tell you, it got so big, and Monday nights are tough to get people out. We'd have over 1,000 people, and it would go till 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and most people would have to go to work, and we'd have to clean up. So I'm super excited that it's going to be on a Saturday.
Yeah, that's awesome. What are the details of the actual date, time, location?
You're going to be at UNLV, the student union. Pretty much we have the whole student union, and if you're familiar with UNLV, the outside courtyard and their conference areas. So Saturday, there's going to be a food court there. So it's right above the food court. So there's going to be food. It's February 10th, starting at 9 in the morning is when our first clinical classes start. Tara Connor will, our keynote speaker, former Miss USA, she will go on. The programming will start at 1 p.m. We'll have a little music video. We're going to do a sobriety countdown. The resource fair is going to be open so people can walk around to other tables and check out what services are available here in Las Vegas, and they can pick up all the collateral information. And Tara Connor will go on somewhere between 1:30 around, and she should talk till about 2:15.
Okay, nice. Now, what is Tara Connor, former Miss USA, talking about in her keynote speech?
It will be super interesting. She was former Miss USA in 2006, and she had her crown taken from her, stripped from her, because she was using cocaine and drinking. And they did not think that it was very much in alignment with Miss USA's standards. So she's been a recovery advocate since then. So she's got a long history of speaking publicly nationally about the benefits of recovery.
Wow, that's fantastic. Okay. Now, there's a high school in downtown Las Vegas, Mission High School, that you and some of your board members pushed for CCSD to establish. What was behind the need for that school?
Well, Mission High School, me, Don Jersey, and Jeff Horn, we called ourselves the Three Amigos. We became fast friends, and we all decided that it was a good idea to get behind the idea of rebranding one of the behavioral health type schools into a loving, nurturing recovery environment. We believe that that's the way that we're going to help these adolescents the best, is with wrapping them around with a loving, nurturing arms rather than punitive measures. And certainly these kids, they will pick up and use again. The results are, at an adolescent getting sober, the odds are really against them. So we have some fair amount of longevity now. And they seem to, the numbers are in, the outcomes are good. I mean, these kids are reporting less substance use. They're not all 100% abstinent, but that would be great. But the idea that for them to get better is out there, and they know that there's a group of people that will want to help them. So that was really the idea behind it, is to change the punitive measures and, make it a more loving, nurturing environment.
So kids from all over the valley who are high school age can choose to go to Mission High School in downtown?
Correct. And that's a big portion of it, is it voluntary? They're not sentenced to go. They don't have to be there. So they have to want to be there, which is a huge change in what the dynamic of a the behavioral health type schools, because, you know, the kid gets in trouble, he gets caught with some substances, and they put him to the bad kid school. And that's just, you know, contrary to what we believe. We believe that they have to want to get better themselves.
Yeah. Okay. That's awesome. All right. So where can listeners go if they want to find out more about There Is No Hero in Heroin Foundation or your upcoming RECON recovery conference?
Our website, our acronym for our name, There Is No Hero in Heroin. The acronym is TINHIH. So tinhih.org, TINHIH.org. And that will have all the links for all the services that we provide, our monthly calendar that we put up for the after school programming that we do, and a patient portal. If someone wanted to enter into services with us, they can, you know, our electronic health record is connected through our website as well.
Okay, awesome. So once again, the website is TINHIH.org. It stands for There Is No Hero in Heroin, TINHIH.org. You can find out more about the nonprofit organization there and also their annual free RECON Recovery Conference, which is coming up on Saturday, February 10th. Starts at 9 a.m. with some workshops, keynote speaker. Former Miss USA Tara Connor takes the stage in the afternoon, and it's all happening at the UNLV Student Union, 4505 South Maryland. Once again, the website, TINHIH.org. And we've been speaking with Joseph Engel, founder and CEO of the Las Vegas chapter of There Is No Hero in Heroin Foundation. And Joseph, I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing your heart-wrenching story with us and how that prompted you to make a difference to all these kids who are struggling. You know, it takes someone who understands them to really make a difference, and you're that guy. So I appreciate you being here, sharing with us what you're doing, and also letting us know about the upcoming RECON Recovery Conference next month. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you having me.
Everyone has a community to lean on, a neighborhood, school, kids' teams, where you worship, work out, or any other place or group where you choose to belong. Communities can provide support when you need it, and even when you don't know you do. Like when it comes to preventing underage drinking and other substance use. You've talked with your kids and shared clear expectations, but you're not with them every minute. Your community members, friends and relatives, teachers and coaches, faith leaders, and other important adults in your kids' lives can be your eyes, ears, and a supportive influence when you're not around. Reinforcing your messages with your kids and alerting you to warning signs of underage drinking or other substance use. So talk with your kids about these issues and involve the members of your community to help keep your kids safe. Because when you talk, they hear you. For more information, visit talktheyhearyou.samhsa.gov.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Antonio Chacha, president of 3-Axis Advisors. Prescription drug prices have historically been artificially inflated, but for the first time in decades, some changes are being made. Antonio, thank you so much for being here today.
Great to be with you.
So, first of all, what exactly is 3-Axis Advisors?
So, it is a consulting and research firm that I started in 2019. With the idea of demystifying prescription drug transactions for employers, government programs, and the public at large.
Okay, so what's currently happening on Capitol Hill that might affect prescription drug prices?
Well, it should come as no secret that every year the prices of medicines are going up. But in the United States, and in the United States alone, there is a significant disconnect between the list prices of medicines and the actual amount of money that drug makers bring in. What I mean by that is that the prices are set in the United States as a starting point, and there is a negotiated rebates and kickbacks off the top of those list prices. We as consumers and employers in the United States, the difference between overpaying and underpaying for medicines is largely predicated on how much of those discounts we're actually realizing when we buy those medicines. Unfortunately, we've relied on health insurance companies and little known intermediaries known as pharmacy benefit managers or PBMs to help insulate us from the inflated costs of medicines. But they make money as a percentage off the list price of the medicine. So when they're picking which medicines to cover under our insurance benefit plans, oftentimes they're making more money off the higher priced medicines and thus favoring them. So Congress is taking a laser sharp focus at this perverse incentive to try and delink PBM compensation off the list prices of medicines such that we as consumers have better access to lower cost medicines.
Okay. Now, when you're talking about pharmacy benefit managers or PBMs, are these organizations that we have heard of, or do they work silently in the background and we don't know they exist?
Well, I think, you know, we should know that they exist, but if the question is, do people know they exist? Generally not. There are three large PBMs that essentially make up about 80 to 85% of the entire prescription drug marketplace. To contextualize that, 95% of transactions at the pharmacy counter are being processed through insurance. So they make up to 85% of that. Now, the companies are OptumRx, Express Scripts, and CVS Caremark. You might recognize the name CVS from the pharmacy chain, but these are very stealthy intermediaries, if you will, that were brought in to act as friction against drug manufacturers and pharmacies who, left to their own devices, would love to charge as much as they could. But these intermediaries have grown big time and have made a lot of money off the transactions, to the point where those three companies are now larger than the pharmacies and drug manufacturers they were hired to control. They are now Fortune 15 companies.
Okay, so basically what's going on is there are multiple layers of middlemen who are all making a profit, and as a result, we end up paying more than we should for prescription drugs?
You distilled it very well.
Okay. All right, so what exactly is the federal legislation trying to do in order to control this and pass more savings on to us?
So the Protecting Patients Against PBM Abuses Act does a number of things, not to get rid of PBMs, but to really, I would argue, restore their original purpose. You know, PBMs are not inherently evil. We understand that everybody in the drug supply chain wants to make money off the transaction, but PBMs were brought in to do the opposite, to control the amount of fluff that was padded into the cost of a medicine. But as soon as they started tasting the forbidden fruit, making money off the very transaction they were hired to make more efficient, well, things started to get out of control. So we see routine instances where there might be a brand drug that could be thousands of dollars and a generic alternative that could be less than $500. And the PBM will continue forcing patients to shell out money out of pocket for the expensive brand medicine, while the generic drug essentially collects dust on the pharmacy shelf. What this policy would aim to do is to, again, de-link PBM compensation off the list prices of medicine to make them essentially more agnostic to which medicines they prefer. It's not a healthy incentive for PBMs to make money when they're covering medicines that are more expensive. So by de-linking their compensation off the list price of medicine, essentially moving them to a flat fee, the end goal is to make them a little bit more objective when making decisions on our behalf.
Okay. Now, typically when I go to the pharmacy, they offer the generic drug first. So do PBMs not make any money off those transactions?
Oh, they absolutely do.
Okay.
You don't become a Fortune 15 company by just making money off one segment of the marketplace. Brand drugs make up about 13% of all pharmacy transactions, which means generics are the prevailing market segment that we as consumers ultimately access. PBMs make money off generic drugs through a practice called spread pricing. So it's a little bit of a heads you win, tails they lose type thing. The generic drugs in general are very cheap and they're deflating significantly over time. In my home state of Ohio, we found, this is actually how I started doing what I do. Pharmacies in the state of Ohio were complaining about massive underpayments in our Medicaid managed care program on generic drugs. They were essentially buying medicines for a certain price and not even getting paid by PBMs the actual cost of the drug. When I went back to state officials and asked what was happening, they looked at me like I was crazy because they said their costs were going up. So those two things don't make sense. How can pharmacies be getting paid less within the Medicaid program, but the Medicaid program not getting the benefit of the savings of those underpayments? What we found was that PBMs were essentially playing the float. They were paying pharmacies low and billing a much higher price back to the state of Ohio and pocketing the difference. After we created the crumb trail that led investigators to this scheme, they found it to be $245 million of spread pricing, is what we called it, within our Medicaid managed care program. And that was just 1 year. So arguably, people got really upset over these hidden markups that PBMs were taking off the top. The policy that is being offered in Congress that delinks PBM compensation off list prices of medicines would actually also prohibit this practice of spread pricing, making sure that PBMs aren't layering on hidden markups on generic drugs.
Okay. Now, when you're talking about PBMs, it kind of reminds me of the cavalry coming in to save the day, but then they turn on you and shoot you instead.
I've often referred to them as the arsonists and firefighters of high drug prices. They are providing savings relative to our bloated prices, but they are somewhat responsible for our bloated prices, not solely. Certainly, everybody else has a hand in it as well. But then they also provide a fictitious amount of savings on those medicines. The problem is they often keep the savings for themselves and not pass it through to the patient and the payer.
Okay. So what is the PBM Accountability Project?
So the PBM Accountability Project is a contingency of trade unions, employers, provider groups, folks who have essentially skin in the game on how PBMs operate in the marketplace. Now, every group has different bones to pick. As an example, pharmacy groups may not like PBMs because PBMs don't pay them as much as they would like. Far be it for me to say what a fair rate is to pay a pharmacy or not, but pharmacies can be hindered significantly by some of the business practice of PBMs. Likewise, if you're a trade union or your employer, you're paying for pharmacy benefits as part of your benefit package for employees. So anytime that a PBM is engaging in what we would just maybe unfairly categorize as nefarious activities, the bill ultimately comes due and it's the employers and patients that pay it.
All right. So this is obviously a complicated topic with a lot to learn. So how do people find out more about 3-Axis Advisors and what you do, or about the PBM Accountability Project, or learn more about the legislation that's happening on Capitol Hill?
Yeah. So the PBM Accountability Project is a client of ours. We do data analytics and research for them, and they can be found at pbmaccountability.org. My firm, where you can learn everything that you've probably ever wanted to know and didn't want to know about prescription drug pricing, is the number 3axisadvisors.com.
Okay, awesome. So the PBM Accountability Project website, pbmaccountability.org, pbmaccountability.org. And if you want to find out more about what Antonio does with 3-Axis Advisors, it's 3-Axis, A-X-I-S, advisors.com, the number 3-Axis Advisors.com. And we've been speaking with Antonio Chacha. He is the president of 3-Axis Advisors and obviously an expert on PBMs, which stand for pharmacy benefit managers, and what's going on with legislation that affects what we pay for prescription drugs. So, Antonio, I want to thank you so much for being here, bringing us up to date on what's going on and what we should be aware of and how a difference is being made. So I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Charlie did not die from an overdose. Charlie was poisoned.
Websites and social media selling fake medicines may look legitimate, but they're not.
He died in less than 15 minutes after taking the pill.
Any medication not purchased from a licensed pharmacy could be deadly.
No other family should go through this. It's just horrific.
Go to safe.pharmacy. Learn about fake medicine on social media and if an online pharmacy is safe.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Dr. Kenneth E. Thorpe, chairman of the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease and a professor and chair at Emory University. The FDA has recently approved new treatments that can slow the progression of Alzheimer's in the early stages of the disease, but access to these treatments is a different story. Dr. Thorpe, thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me on.
So what is the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease?
Well, it's a not-for-profit coalition of about 80 organizations, patient groups, business, labor, health plans, health insurance companies that are really focusing on three things: preventing the growth in chronic disease, finding ways for earlier detection of chronic disease, and finally, more effective ways of engaging and working with patients that have multiple chronic healthcare conditions. So our focus, obviously, being on chronic disease because it's over 90% of what we spend on healthcare.
Wow. Okay. Now, how common is Alzheimer's disease in the U.S.?
Well, right now, there's about 6 million people that have Alzheimer's, progressive disease. About 2,000 people each day progress from mild to moderate Alzheimer's. But we think the projections are that it's going to grow substantially, more than double within the next 20 or 30 years to 13, 14 million people. So it's a significant and growing issue.
Yeah, absolutely. Why do you project that kind of growth, more than double?
Well, I think it's in part demographics, but it's also we're doing a better job of identifying early signs of it and identifying it through imaging technologies that have evolved over the last several years. So our ability to identify the signs of early onset in particular, and then having the scanning capacity to really identify the plaque buildup in the brain, you know, has been an innovation that has happened over the last several years.
Okay, so up until now, what have been some of the challenges with diagnosing Alzheimer's disease early? Is it just the lack of technology?
I think it's not just understanding the symptoms. It could be as subtle as ongoing memory loss, issues around speech. A lot of times people just simply confuse it with the aging process, which is not part of the normal aging process. So I think that seniors and their families in particular have become, you know, more educated about understanding some of these symptoms. And if they do occur, to go ahead and consult with your physician to see about a diagnosis of whether you do have early onset Alzheimer's or not.
Okay, now that's a good point to highlight before we go on. So if we have a loved one or even ourselves, if we find ourselves forgetting more often, we tend to chalk that up to, oh, it's just about getting older. Oh, it's just a senior moment. How do we know when it's worth investigating further and finding out if it might be Alzheimer's?
I think if it gets progressively worse, that if you have initial memory loss, but if it seems to be getting worse over a several week or several month period, it'd be at that point in time that you should get in touch with your physician.
Okay. Now, what are some of these new FDA-approved treatments?
Well, we do have two new medications, the good news, that have come onto the market that have both shown to slow the progression of early onset Alzheimer's. So that's really positive. Not for, you know, obviously for patients and their families, that keeps them out of memory loss centers and out of long-term care facilities. And it's been a real positive development. The bad news is that the Medicare program has decided not to pay for those medications unless the physician enrolls the patient into a clinical trial or a registry. Highly unusual, completely unprecedented. And, you know, for our coalition, we have concern beyond, not only for the Alzheimer's community, but certainly for access to other patient populations for new drugs that may be coming downstream in the future.
Okay, so if it's unusual and unprecedented, why is Medicare now requiring people to enroll in tests, basically, before being given access to the medication?
Well, that's a good question, because the FDA's already approved it as not only being safe and effective, but also having a clinical result that slows the buildup of plaque in the brain compared to not using the medication. So that's sort of the hallmark of dementia and Alzheimer's. So we've already seen a clinical benefit, and it has been deemed to be approved and safe and effective. The only thing I can think of is that there is obviously an upfront cost associated with the medication. It's about $25,000, $26,000 a year. But to put that into context, you know, for a family that doesn't have access to that medication, and doesn't have any other treatment options, you know, putting a loved one into a memory loss center, well, you're going to spend that much money in 2 or 3 months.
Yeah. So there was no communication from Medicare stating, because of the nature of this medication for this particular instance, one time only, we're requiring patients to go through clinical studies?
Pretty much, yep. And, you know, that's going to take time. You know, doing a clinical trial is time consuming and expensive. And secondly, a lot of, take your state, there are a lot of seniors that don't necessarily live near a medical center, which really traditionally conducts these medical trials. So if I live in a rural part of the state, I'm really not going to have access to enrolling in a clinical trial. And as a result, really not going to have Medicare help me with the financial costs associated with medication.
Yeah. Okay. Now, if I'm trying to look at the positive side of this, if someone's going through a clinical trial for a medication and they're receiving ongoing doses of the medication, does that happen on a similar time frame to if they were actually just being treated by their doctor with that medication?
Yeah, pretty much. So the treatment regimens would be similar. So if suppose a Medicare didn't require this, you know, your physician would, you know, prescribe a treatment regimen of the medication that would be, you know, exactly the same as what you would see in a clinical trial.
Okay. Now, are these placebo trials? So someone might end up with a placebo instead of the medication?
No, they're really looking at pre and post.
Okay.
So they're doing measurements of before the medication plaque buildup and then tracking, you know, how the patient is responding post-medication. The earlier ones that where the FDA has already done a handful of studies, 2 or 3 studies that have been conducted, that was a randomized controlled trial where they were looking at patients that had the medication compared to patients who didn't. And the patients who didn't receive the medication had, there was no impact on plaque buildup, whereas the patients that had the medication, there was a reduction in buildup. So we do have that data already on about 3,500 patients.
Okay, so that's the type of study that happens before the FDA approves the medication.
Right.
Okay. So besides the inconvenience to patients, which is obvious if they have to keep going into the center, especially if they don't live near it, what other issues are there around this type of procedure?
Well, I think it's the time. I mean, it's going to delay substantially the broader access to these innovative medications to the, you know, the whole population that could potentially benefit from it. And as I mentioned, obviously not all the patients who could potentially benefit from this and who would otherwise receive it will be enrolled in a clinical trial. So there's going to be people left out. And it's going to be people that really, either transportation-wise or for other reasons, they don't know about it, just really don't have access to enrolling in a clinical trial.
What kind of expectations do you have around Medicare potentially making this type of coverage contingent on clinical studies for other medications and other medical conditions?
Well, we're certainly concerned that Medicare could start making these coverage conditions contingent on people participating in clinical trials for other things like new cancer medications. Obviously, the administration has made reducing cancer deaths a big priority and really trying to encourage innovation in the drug discovery marketplace to make that a reality. Well, I mean, that would kind of work counter to that goal. If you have innovation in developing, let's say, new cancer drugs that do reduce morbidity and mortality among cancer patients, but again, require patients to enroll in a clinical trial. So as noted, unprecedented, and we're certainly concerned about the direction this could potentially go.
Yeah. Okay, so now that the precedent has been set with the Alzheimer's medication, what is the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease doing to try to make sure that it doesn't continue happening?
Well, a couple of things. We're trying to raise awareness of it. So we have a wealth of information on our website at pfcdatz.org. It's www.pfcdalz.org. But secondly, I think that, you know, as patients and their loved ones become aware of this, I think it would be important to make members of Congress aware, to get in contact with your member of Congress and the 2 U.S. senators there in Nevada, just to make them aware that Medicare has gone in this direction. I don't know that it's widely understood and known. But I think, a decision with this type of consequence, policymakers should be aware of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so if you're listening and you want to help make a difference, contact members of Congress, let them know. And you can also check out the website for more information. It's pfcdalz.org. So that stands for Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease, PFCD, ALZ for Alzheimer's, pfcdalz.org. And you can find out more information from the Partnership to Fight Chronic Disease, more information about these new clinical trials that Alzheimer's patients are being required to go through, and also some information that can help you and your family if you are facing this type of challenge. So, Dr. Thorpe, I want to thank you so much. I really appreciate you being here and letting us know more about this situation and what can be done about it and what you expect for the future. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Well, thanks for having me on. My pleasure.
Have you made your 2024 memory screening appointment yet? Annual memory screening should be a part of everyone's health and wellness routine, even if you're not currently experiencing memory problems. The Alzheimer's Foundation of America offers free memory screenings every weekday with no minimum age or insurance prerequisites. Learn more about memory screenings and schedule your free memory screening appointment by contacting the Alzheimer's Foundation of America at 866-232-8484 or visiting www.alzfdn.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Cashin, president of the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry, or AAPD, and board member for the AAPD Foundation. February is National Children's Dental Health Month, so this is a good time to start looking at dental habits for kids. Dr. Cashin, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me, Heather.
So, first of all, what exactly is the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry?
The American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry is a member organization of pediatric dentists who, what our main goal is to have optimal oral health care for all children.
Okay, and what's the AAPD Foundation?
So our foundation is our philanthropic arm of our organization, and what their main goal is to provide access to care for children across our nation. I'm really proud of the work that we're doing within our foundation, as over the last 10 years, we have provided over $10 million worth of access to care grants to children across the nation that has affected over 800,000 children getting care, oral health care, I should say, for their teeth where they might not otherwise have been able to get that care. And that's a really exciting thing because we're not just stopping there. This is just the start of us really working towards that goal of providing optimal oral health care for all children.
Okay. And how does the foundation identify underserved families or areas of population that are good to focus on?
Well, that's great. In most communities, there are oral health clinics or dental clinics, if you will, that identify the children that might qualify that are not able to get care in other ways due to their family circumstances or whatever it may be. So we really work in conjunction with communities across the nation to identify the great work that they're doing and how we might be able to help them with our access to care grants.
Okay, awesome. So obviously, dental health is important for kids. So when should a child have their first dental visit?
Awesome. Yes, we actually recommend having that first dental visit by the age of one or when the first tooth comes into the mouth. And some people say, well, that seems a little bit early when there's only one or two teeth in the mouth at that early of an age. But what we say is that if we get them started early, we educate parents on what they need to do for home care, that we know that they will have a lifetime of healthy teeth, and then that ultimately results in them having a lifetime of being healthy in general, because we know oral health is tied to overall health.
Okay, and what happens if a parent doesn't take the child to the dentist at an early age like that?
Well, obviously, we hope nothing, but if we don't get that oral health care and the parents are not understanding about how to brush the teeth correctly, how to limit sweetened sugary beverages and unhealthy snacks, we know that a cavity can start, or a mouth monster, if you will. And if that cavity or mouth monster starts and it's not taken care of because they don't visit the dentist, the only time that they may go is when it's a problem, when the tooth's hurting, there's a toothache, there's a big hole in the tooth, and it makes it much harder and not as much fun for the child if they have to go in for their first time when there's a big problem versus if they go early, we can help them prevent having those big issues with the teeth.
Yeah, that makes sense. We don't want to have those mouth monsters.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay. Now, how are pediatric dentists different from family dentists?
So first of all, it's our training. We have 2 to 3 more years after dental school to really focus in on children, infants, adolescents, and children with special healthcare needs. We learn how to work with their behavior and when they don't really like what we're doing, how we can work through that with them. In addition, our offices are just set up in a different way to really accommodate children, make it a fun, happy place, not so sterile or just more formal like our dental offices for us as adults. And then we just want to have a lot of fun because we want them to come back to the dentist and be like, I want to go to the dentist today, mom, you know, and not be like scared of going. So that's how pediatric dentists sort of differ from maybe your family dentist.
Okay. And what are some of the latest trends in pediatric oral health care?
So I'll tell you, lots of great things are happening in pediatric dentistry and pediatric oral health care. I always tell families that tooth decay is preventable. And so there's so many things we can do to prevent that, that of course being the home care and visiting the dentist on a regular basis. And then I tell families, when you go to the dentist, ask your pediatric dentist, like, what's the latest and greatest things you're doing to help prevent cavities? And if we do get a cavity, what is the greatest things you're doing to help fix those teeth? And so I just encourage folks just to ask those questions when they're visiting their local pediatric dentist.
Okay. And if I were to ask you as a pediatric dentist, what would your answer be?
So if you were to ask me, I would say it's prevention because we have so many things now that we can show parents techniques on brushing, flossing, swishes and rinses of fluoride that can help prevent cavities. And if we have to fix something, we've got some really great things that don't always require what I call an ouchie or a pinch that we can do to fix teeth. So I think just really lots of good and innovative things that are out there for children so that we can make that experience as positive as possible.
Yeah. Okay. And it seems like brushing techniques have changed over the years. So are there specific tips or strategies that you recommend parents do with their kids at home to basically establish those healthy habits when brushing and making sure that they're doing it properly for that prevention that you're talking about?
Absolutely. So what I first say is 2 minutes, 2 times a day with brushing, generally in the morning before school and at night before bedtime, flossing once a day to get that the food out from in between the teeth. And with the brushing techniques, what I tell it, the young children that maybe up to the age of where you can tie your shoe, I say parents should be in there helping them because kids are going to put the toothbrush in their mouth and they're going to move it around and they're going to get the front ones basically pretty good. But those back ones are a little bit harder for the younger kids. So I just say parents, let them have their turn. Then you take a turn. You aim for that gum line, which is just the pink stuff in the mouth. That's kind of where the tooth and that pink stuff kind of meet. And if you aim for that, you're going to go back and forth and then brush up and down. You're going to get the whole tooth clean. And you just do that on all parts of the tooth. That's just sort of a basic little brushing lesson. But if you're doing that and doing your flossing, you're going to, you know, hold off those mouth monsters as much as possible. And then, of course, diet is always an important key there. And just parents, you know, special treats are always going to be important. And I wouldn't say not having them, but I would definitely say moderation and then go with the healthier snacks. And that means snacks that don't have added sugars. And that's a little bit tricky. So you got to read the labels sometimes with those.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you mentioned flossing once a day, and obviously we all know that's important, but we also know that a lot of people don't like flossing and don't floss, and especially with the kids, you know, sometimes it's hard to teach them the right techniques. So are there any alternatives if the kid just can't or won't floss?
You know, what I say is that don't let there be alternatives for the parents. And I know that sounds kind of crazy, but like just insist on doing it, even if you're not actually being as thorough as you want to be at first. If you kind of get them in the habit, number one, they're going to like realize that it's not going to matter what they say or do. It's going to happen. And then what will happen is technique wise, the parents are going to learn how to get the floss in there. I will say that using sometimes a floss holder instead of your fingers, because some of our fingers can be a little bit bigger and it makes it a little difficult. And then it makes it hard if the child has a small mouth, is using a, like we call it a flosser. And you can buy that at your local drugstore. And that will help you as well. But I would say in general, we want to like encourage to do that, even though it's not always the most fun thing. And maybe you start out just doing it every other day and then you work up to every day. But definitely don't want to leave that out, because that's where those little mouth monsters like to hide, is in between the teeth where they're tight together.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So where can listeners go if they want to find out more information about pediatric dentistry or about oral health care for kids for National Children's Dental Health Month?
Well, I would encourage you to go to aapdfoundation.org. There is a lot of information covering what we talked about today and a little bit more in depth, some techniques on how to brush teeth and ways to find a pediatric dentist in your local area.
Okay, awesome. So aapdfoundation.org is the website to go to. Stands for American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry Foundation, aapdfoundation.org. And we've been speaking with Dr. Scott Cashin. He's the president of the American Academy of Pediatric Dentistry and a board member for the AAPD Foundation. And February, of course, is National Children's Dental Health Month. Dr. Cashin, I want to thank you so much for being here and sharing your expertise and the new trends and dental habits with us today. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Heather. I really appreciate it and enjoy talking with you.
After I lost my mom, I lost my way. Then I found youth advocate programs, behavioral health services.
As a little kid, I made some mistakes, but I'm not a mistake.
YAP gives communities alternatives to residential care, youth incarceration, and neighborhood violence. After completing our program, nearly 90% of participants remain in their community. YAP works.
I'm working towards a bright future.
Youth advocate programs. Others talk social change. We make it happen. Learn more at yapinc.org.
I'm Heather Vale, and this is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Gene O'Neill, CEO, and Dr. Dana Varble, Chief Veterinary Officer of the North American Veterinary Community, or NAVC. The nonprofit organization is the world's leading provider of veterinary continuing education and is dedicated to supporting and advancing veterinary professionals worldwide. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thank you. Yes.
So, Gene, what exactly does the North American veterinary community do on a day-to-day basis?
So the North American veterinary community, we are the world's largest education provider for anyone in the veterinary professional space. That's veterinarians, technicians, nurses. We hold things like live events, which is what we're here this week for. We call it VMX, where we are with 28,000 of our closest veterinary professional friends. We have over 700 exhibitors here. So we're here to explore and to divulge to the public what the newest innovations and products are from the industry coming out to help your pets have a longer, healthier, and happier life.
Yeah, awesome. So Dr. Varble, what are some of the new veterinary trends that could impact our four-legged friends?
In the past, we've always had to take human medications as veterinarians and kind of adapt them into the animal world. For the first time ever, we're seeing medications developed specifically for dogs or specifically for cats. In general, just specifically for animals. And for us, that means that we're better able to predict how these medications are going to work. They tend to have less side effects, and they're just more effective. So things like pain medication that was developed specifically for dogs or pain medication developed specifically for cats, again, rather than having to kind of adapt human medications to our patients, we have these really great effective medications to share with pet owners these days.
Okay, so what's the difference that would make, let's say, a painkiller more suited to a dog specifically?
Yeah, great question. So the new medications I just talked about are actually monoclonal antibodies. So monoclonal antibodies are something that we use in human medicine as well, but an antibody is always developed specifically for a dog or an antibody for a cat. And these medications actually disrupt pain pathways in a totally new and different way. So we've traditionally used a lot of anti-inflammatory medications, medications very similar to ibuprofen. but dogs, and especially cats, are very sensitive to those medications, and they tend to have a lot of side effects, even when they're used safely. So now these monoclonal antibodies have far less side effects and are far more effective than those other medications.
Wow, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Okay, now what about artificial intelligence? What ways are AI being used by veterinarians?
So what we're seeing here is some of the latest things that are coming out, and I look at this as the biggest asset in the veterinary clinic or hospital is the veterinarian's time. So the more time they can spend with the pets, the more they can care for them for their longer, happier, healthier lives. So some of the technology that's coming out allows them to do that by analyzing samples, let's say, or creating records for them so they don't have to spend the administrative time doing all that at the end of the day. So these are the things that are really helping the profession grow and also helping them spend more time with the pets.
Wow. Okay. Awesome. So what kind of demand is there for more veterinarians as a career path?
Yeah, so the demand for veterinarians is really a worldwide issue. You know, here in the States, about 93% of all veterinarians are white. So what we're trying to do here for the second year in a row is to expose to the middle schoolers from the underrepresented communities what it's like to be a veterinarian or a veterinary nurse for a day. So they'll dress in scrubs, they'll shadow veterinarians, they'll work on model dogs for things like placing sutures or drawing blood, just so you can inspire them and have them think about what it would be like to be a veterinarian and possibly pursue a career in veterinary medicine.
That sounds fantastic. All right, now let's talk about some of the trends in actual pet choices. So what are some of the most popular dog breeds right now? And also as far as exotic pets go?
So for the first time ever, the most popular dog breed in the U.S. are French Bulldogs. And while they're super cute with their squished-in faces and big eyes, that face shape means that they have unique health problems, especially when it comes to breathing, but even when it comes to stomach and digestive problems. So as veterinarians, it's more important than ever that we understand what those problems are and explore new ways to treat them so that we have a variety of options to offer owners. In the exotic pet world, we're seeing bearded dragons become more popular than ever. And these little lizards make great pets. They're extremely docile, but we know they have very specific husbandry needs when it comes to things like food, lighting, and heat. So we really want to be able, as veterinarians, to recommend the very best options to take care of those pets.
Okay, and is it important for potential pet owners to consider these health issues as well before making the decision to get the pet?
Absolutely. Every family has different kind of expectations of pets. You know, if you want somebody who's going to cuddle in bed with you at night, maybe a bearded dragon isn't going to be the choice for you. But, you know, if you have dog allergies, maybe a bearded dragon is going to be a great option for you and your kids to really start exploring how to take care of a pet and form a really unique human-animal bond with a new animal.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so where can listeners go if they want to find out more information about the North American Veterinary Community as an organization, or just find out more about pet trends in general that you've talked about today, from the medication that's targeted to pets specifically to AI and the need for new diverse veterinarians?
Sure. Anyone can go to NAVC.com to learn more about what you just said and more.
Okay, awesome. So NAVC.com is the website to go to. It stands for North American Veterinary Community, NAVC.com. And we've been speaking with Gene O'Neill. He's the CEO, and Dr. Dana Varble is the Chief Veterinary Officer of the organization. And I want to thank you both so much for being here and sharing with us the new trends that a lot of them sound very inspirational and positive as an outlook for us pet owners in the future. So I really appreciate you being here and sharing your expertise with us. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Kirsten from Pentatonix. We've all learned how to cope with more time alone. With more time spent isolated or at home, the need for companionship has grown. If you've considered adding a pet to your family, please check with your local shelters and foster organizations. Stray pet numbers have grown immensely over the past several years, and the trauma caused to these animals is devastating. Adopt pets, they need us more than we know. This message is courtesy of the United States Air Force.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, January 22nd at 8 p.m. benefiting Free International, and Monday, February 5th at 8 p.m. benefiting ALS of Southern Nevada. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The Year of the Dragon will kick off with the annual Lunar New Year Parade on Friday, February 9th at 6 p.m. on Park Center Drive in downtown Summerlin. Festivities also include traditional dragon and lion dances, fan dancers, stilt walkers, and more. Find out all the details for this free community celebration at summerlin.com under events. That's summerlin.com under events. And the nonprofit organization There Is No Hero and Heroine Foundation of Las Vegas is hosting its free annual Recon Recovery Conference featuring former Miss USA Tara Connor on Saturday, February 10th, with workshops at 9 a.m., keynote speaker at 1:30 p.m., and a resource fair at 2:30 p.m. at the UNLV Student Union, 4505 South Maryland Parkway. Find out more info about the organization and the conference at tinhih.org. That stands for There Is No Hero in Heroine, tinhih.org.